Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Thursday, April 1st, 2021. Here are some of your headlines. More emotional testimony in the Derek Chauvin murder trial and the death of George Floyd. Floyd's girlfriend crying as she tells how the couple first met at a shelter where Floyd was a security guard and how they both struggled with opioid addiction. But it was Floyd's drug use and the role it may have played in his death that came under scrutiny during lawyers' questioning. President Joe Biden holds his first cabinet meeting a day after he presented a more than $2 trillion infrastructure spending proposal. Today, he designated five department secretaries as emissaries to explain the plan to the American people. Police in Orange, California say the mass shooting Wednesday night appears to be an isolated incident in which the suspect and the victims knew each other. One of the victims is a 9-year-old boy. And it's Major League Baseball's opening day. After a shortened 60-game season in 2020, this year promises a full 162 games with some fans in the stands. But it's not all going smoothly this first day. Washington Nationals home opener with the New York Mets postponed due to coronavirus concerns after positive tests in the clubhouse. Now to the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer charged in the death of George Floyd during an arrest last year for allegedly using a fake $20 bill. Video of Chauvin with his knee on Floyd's neck for 9.5 minutes has been played repeatedly for the jury. The defense claiming that the main cause of death was not that. Instead, it was Floyd's pre-existing medical conditions and his drug use. And drugs was the focus of this line of questioning by defense attorney Eric Nelson. And you'll hear from prosecutor Matthew Frank. The witness is George Floyd's girlfriend, Courtney Ross.
You and Floyd, Mr. Floyd, excuse me, I'm assuming like most couples had pet names for each other.
Yeah.
And what was his name for you? I mean, what were you saved? Let me strike that. What were you saved in his phone as?
Mama.
Now, approximately a week prior to Mr. Floyd's death, you and Mr. Floyd again purchased pills from Mr. Maurice Hall, correct?
I believe so. I'm not sure.
Do you recall telling the FBI that you bought pills from Mr. Hall 1 week prior to Mr. Floyd's death?
Yes, but I wasn't there. I wasn't there. I didn't see anything happen.
Yesterday, when you met with prosecutors, did you tell them that you were in the car at a hotel?
Yes.
When those pills were purchased?
Yes.
And that you were on the phone with Mr. Floyd at that time?
Yes.
And you heard a voice in the background?
Yes.
And that was a voice you recognized to be from Mr. Hall?
I thought so, yeah.
And so between Mr. Floyd's hospitalization through March and the quarantining and all of that, March and April, Mr. Floyd had been clean during that time frame?
Pardon me?
I'm sorry, if you need a minute.
No, it's okay.
I'm sorry. I want to just, again, time frame becomes important.
Yes.
After Mr. Floyd was hospitalized in March, you were quarantining together, spending a lot of time together in March, April, and May, correct?
Yes.
And for the majority of that time, Mr. Floyd was clean, right?
Yes.
And it was your belief that Mr. Floyd started using again about 2 weeks prior to his death, correct?
I noticed a change in his behavior, yes.
That's when you noticed the changes in his behavior. And you described some of those changes in his behavior in that time frame, right?
Yes.
Do you recall telling the FBI that there would be times that he would just be up and bouncing around, and then there would be times that he would be, like, unintelligible?
I don't recall that, but...
Would you disagree if I said that in the transcript?
No, I wouldn't disagree with that.
Were you aware that Mr. Floyd was with Mr. Hall on May 25th of 2020?
Only in the aftermath.
I have no further questions, Your Honor.
Deputy Director?
Yes, sir. Hello again, Ms. Ross.
Hi,
just a few follow-up questions for you. Maybe try to go in reverse order, but counsel was asking you about, you know, whether you knew these pills were purchased from Mr. Hall.
Yes.
Most recently in May.
Yes.
Talked to you about the hotel incident. And I just want you to clarify for the jury, you're not trying to mislead them or anything. What you're saying is you didn't personally see that sale.
No, I didn't. I just want to say what I saw.
Right. But you think that's probably where those pills came from?
Yes.
You don't dispute that?
No, I don't.
Yeah. You just personally didn't see it?
Exactly.
And incidentally, what did he call his mother? What did he refer to her as?
He called her mama too, but it's just different the way he said it. It's kind of hard to describe.
So if he were to tell us, if he were to say to somebody, mama, that could mean his actual mother.
Yes.
Okay. Just also a name he called you.
Yes.
You were a mother too, right?
Yes.
Still are, I guess. I shouldn't use that.
Some of the testimony from Courtney Ross, who was George Floyd's girlfriend, questions from Matthew Frank, Minnesota Assistant Attorney General, and before that, Eric Nelson, attorney for the man on trial in Floyd's death, former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. C-SPAN has been covering this trial, and if you miss any of it, you can watch the trial replays of that day's testimony each night at 8 p.m. Eastern on C-SPAN 2 television. You heard in the exchange just played defense attorney Nelson referring to Maurice Lester Hall, who was the passenger in the SUV that George Floyd was driving that day. Nelson saying Hall, if called to testify, would say that Floyd injected drugs before police arrived at the SUV. Also, drugs were found in the car. And Christopher Martin, the cashier at Cup Foods that sold Floyd cigarettes and noticed the money was counterfeit, stated as well in this trial that Hall was acting more suspicious than Floyd, adding that he didn't think Floyd knew the money he paid with was counterfeit. Well, Maurice Hall has informed the court that if he's called to testify, he will invoke his constitutional rights under the Fifth Amendment to not answer any questions. President Joe Biden today holding his first cabinet meeting, usually held in the appropriately named cabinet room of the White House, but because of coronavirus social distancing requirements, it was moved to the larger East Room. The president spoke about the big item on his agenda now, the more than $2 trillion infrastructure spending plan that he outlined on Wednesday in Pittsburgh.
We have a lot to discuss, but while the press is here, I want to make one announcement. Yesterday in Pittsburgh, I laid out my vision for rebuilding America and America with America's Jobs program. And while most of the cabinet will have a role in helping shape and press the jobs plan, today I'm announcing that I'm asking 5 cabinet members to take special responsibility to explain the plan to the American public. Working with my team here in the White House, these cabinet members will represent me in dealing with Congress, engage the public in selling the plan, and help work out the details as we refine it and move forward. These 5 members will be Pete Buttigieg, Jennifer Granholm, Marsha Fudge, Marty Walsh, and Gina Raimondo. And I want to thank them in advance for the role they're going to play with this added assignment I'm asking them to take on. And we'll be discussing that today and among other things. And one of those other things, our administration, is a commitment to Buy American, the plan we're putting forward, to make sure that when the government is spending taxpayers' money, that they're spending it on American-made goods, American corporations, and American employees. Today, I'm directing every member of the cabinet, I mean this sincerely, everyone, to take a hard look at their agency spending and make sure it follows my Buy American standard, which we set out in January. I'm going to ask you all to report back to me at the next cabinet meeting, and now we've got a lot of business to do and get done. And I thank the press for being here, but talk to you all later. Thank you.
President Joe Biden not taking any reporters' questions at the start of today's first cabinet meeting of his presidency. Those five department secretaries that he mentioned with the special duties, they head up transportation, energy, housing and urban development, labor, and commerce. The president's plan would fund investments in roads, bridges, transit, clean water, broadband, and more. To pay for it, the president proposes, among other things, an increase in corporate taxes. That's already become a non-starter with many Republicans. Senator Shelley Moore Capito interviewed today by West Virginia Metro News.
Senator, you said that the question is, how are you going to pay for it? Well, President Biden says we'll pay for it by rolling back, among other things, rolling back the Trump Republican tax cuts, which you supported, and the corporate rate would go back up from 21% to 28%. Wouldn't that be publicly pretty popular because most people don't really care about corporations? They care about people. And I know there's a whole theory about who really pays the taxes when corporate taxes go up. But if corporate tax rates went up from 21% to 28%, would your constituents in West Virginia really care that much?
Well, I think that's why he's picked this corporate tax rate as his initial strike in terms of taxes. But I have a problem raising taxes. Before the pandemic, we were really on a roll. We had low unemployment, rising wages, a robust economy all throughout the country, and we were feeling that in West Virginia as well. Obviously, the pandemic has set us back tremendously, and that's what these COVID packages have been about. But anytime you raise taxes, everybody feels it. If a company pays more taxes, they don't invest in more capital, they don't hire more people, they don't raise your wages. So, it's not just we're going to make Amazon pay taxes, which I know he keeps talking about Amazon. We're going to make Amazon pay taxes. What is the effect of that on our whole economy? We're just now getting back on our feet. Why would we want to do anything to sort of stall out that progress? And so that's an issue. Paying for infrastructure is hard, but we've got to think of creative ways to do that.
Senator Shelley Moore Capito, West Virginia Republican on the West Virginia Metro News Radio Network. The Senate Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, also has already come out against the president's infrastructure proposal. The Senate Majority Leader, Democrat Chuck Schumer, is already on record in favor. Politico writing that White House Chief of Staff Ron Klain dodged Thursday on whether congressional Democrats would work to pass President Joe Biden's $2 trillion infrastructure plan through the reconciliation process, potentially skirting the 60-vote threshold required by the Senate filibuster. Klain was interviewed by Politico's chief Washington correspondent, Ryan Lizza.
You're going to get a lot. Everyone's going to be asking you about reconciliation, obviously. It seems like the path of least resistance. What's the argument for not using budget reconciliation, which would avoid, of course, a filibuster?
Well, look, I think what we want to do is get this passed. And I think that starts with a conversation with a broad array of members in both parties to see where the support is, how this looks as we move it through the process. That's our first goal. And I'm not going to get into legislative tactics today. We just launched this plan yesterday. Congress is out of session. We're going to start to bring members down here physically when Congress comes back after this Easter break, and talk to Congress, talk to members of the House and Senate, Democrats, Republicans, about how they want to move forward. We want to move forward, if it's at all possible, on a bipartisan basis. I think there's some hope for that.
Similar with the last bill, bipartisanship is desired but not required, from your perspective, in passing this?
Look, I think these are national needs. And, as the president has said, people have to decide if they're going to deliver or divide. And we intend to deliver. And when I talk to Republicans, I see that they want to deliver too. And I think they, particularly around these infrastructure issues, I do think there's strong bipartisan support. I understand controversy about the pay-fors, controversy about certain specifics. But let's work together and see if there's a way for us to deliver this. In the end, let me be clear, the president was elected to do a job. And part of that job is to get this country ready to win the future. That's what he's going to do. We know it has bipartisan support in the country. And so we're going to try our best to get bipartisan support here in Washington.
White House Chief of Staff Ron Klain at a Politico Playbook virtual interview. Democratic Senator Joe Manchin has already said that he would not vote to use the filibuster-proof budget reconciliation process to pass an infrastructure spending bill. And the Democratic Senate majority would need him if all Republicans vote no. And a tweet today from Republican Senator Mitt Romney, a Senate evenly split between both parties and a bare Democratic House majority are hardly a mandate to go it alone. The president should live up to the bipartisanship he preached in his inaugural address. The fight over the filibuster is the subject of this week's episode of our podcast, The Weekly. The guest is Kimberly Strassel, Wall Street Journal columnist and editorial board member. Here's a portion of it where we ask her whether support for retaining or abolishing the Senate filibuster can be linked in any way to whether your party would benefit in the short term.
So let me conclude with this question, because we've heard in the past from Republican and Democratic leaders, is there hypocrisy on both sides? Is it where you stand depends on whether you are in the majority or the minority?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's always, it's always been the case. But this is why this is very dangerous stuff, Steve, is that people are being very short term about this. And, you know, I look back to 2009, for instance. The Obama administration came in. They were very aggressive. They didn't think about the consequences. They pushed through a lot of legislation that was extremely controversial out there with voters, whether it was the big stimulus bill or the president's health care bill. And the blowback in 2010 was extraordinary. Republicans had one of their best elections, in 65 years or something like that. So, you know, Democrats right now are thinking of blowing up the entire Senate as an institution, even with the knowledge that by next year they might be in the minority in the Senate again. And the 4 years from now, Republicans could be in a place to put through an agenda that would be truly terrifying to a lot of Democrats. So, you know, this is one of those moments where people ought to sit back and try to remember that these kind of big actions could have real consequences down the road.
Kimberly Strassel, Wall Street Journal columnist and editorial board member on the Senate filibuster. Our guest on C-SPAN's podcast, The Weekly. It is available after midnight tonight, wherever you get your podcasts. More on President Biden's infrastructure spending proposal, more than $2 trillion. It is expected to have an easier time passing the House, where only a simple majority vote is needed. But Democrats there will only have a 7-seat majority once Republican Representative-elect Julia Letlow is sworn in. And that means they can only lose 3 Democratic votes on a bill and still pass it if no Republican votes yes. Some Democratic progressives in the House, including Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, already saying the price tag on the president's plan is too small. It needs to be way bigger. And a group of moderate and suburban Democrats say they will vote no if the bill in the end does not repeal the 2017 tax bill's cap on state and local tax deduction, also known as SALT. It was a $10,000 cap. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi asked about that today during her weekly briefing.
All right. Our next question will be Jake Sherman with Punchbowl News.
How are you?
I'm
curious what you think of Gottheimer and his crew saying they won't vote for anything with changes to the tax code without the SALT caps undone. I'm curious what you think of that and how you see that playing into the package.
Well, I'm a big supporter of their position, as you probably know. It was devastating to the state of California for the members, the Republican members of California, to vote against our state. And by the way, without any consultation with the finance director of the state as to what impact it would have on our meeting the needs of the people of California. They have the same view, I'm sure, in New Jersey, New York, other states that had been affected by this. And, it was a political action on the part of the Republicans in a tax bill that gave 83% of the benefits to the top 1%, the injustice of it all. So I'm sympathetic to their position. I would say that I would withhold any comment about whether you're going to vote for a bill or not until you see what the bill is. But again, I share their exuberance about the subject. of the salt tax. It was mean-spirited to begin with, politically targeted. It had no place for, in that. Well, that was a tax scam to begin with, so it was a mess all around. Hopefully we can get it into the bill. I never give up hope for something like that. It means so much to the American people.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi at her weekly press conference. It was held virtually today. She has told members of her caucus she wants to pass the infrastructure spending bill by the 4th of July. On Wall Street, the Dow was up 171, NASDAQ up 233, and S&P up 46. The S&P 500 has crossed the 4,000 mark for the first time. It took a year and a half after it reached the 3,000 mark. The number of Americans applying for unemployment benefits rose last week by 61,000 to 719,000. In all, 18.2 million people still getting some type of jobless aid, both traditional state benefits and any special federal benefits passed during the coronavirus pandemic in the past year. Also reported today that U.S. manufacturers expanded in March at the fastest pace in 37 years. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi today also commenting about Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz and the investigation of Gaetz by the Justice Department over whether he violated federal anti-trafficking laws by having a sexual relationship with a 17-year-old and paying for her to travel with him.
Our first question will go to Emily Cochran with the New York Times.
Hi, Madam Speaker. Thank you for doing this. I wanted to ask, given the allegations against Matt Gaetz, do you think he should still remain a member of Congress? Should he step down? And if anything, should he be removed from judiciary?
Well, we have so much going on in our country that hopefully we will get back to. But in terms of that, and I think it's an important issue, the integrity of the Congress, not to minimize that. It just surprised me that that was the first question, and I'm really surprised. If in fact these allegations are true, of course, being removed from the Judiciary Committee is the least that could be done. I think from what we've heard so far, this would be a matter for the Ethics Committee.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Congressman Gaetz has denied that anything was wrong with what he did, and he also says the sex trafficking investigation into him is part of a plot to extort his family for $25 million. And today, Fox News putting out a statement after a report in the Daily Beast on Wednesday that Gaetz was talking with people at Fox News, also One America News Network and Newsmax about possible jobs. Fox News statement reads, "No one with any level of authority has had conversations with Matt Gaetz for any of our platforms, and we have no interest in hiring him." Washington Today continues in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today. A few more headlines, some decisions from the U.S. Supreme Court to let the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, loosen restrictions on ownership of local media outlets that could lead to more industry consolidation. Another decision to let Facebook send notifications to alert users to suspicious logins without violating a federal law aimed at stopping robocalls and automated text messages. And a third decision on the side of Georgia against Florida in a decades-long dispute over water rights. Also, a decision from Virginia's Supreme Court today that a ban on removal of war memorials does not apply to those built before 1997. Which includes two statues of Confederate generals in the city of Charlottesville. They are Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson. Today's decision paving the way for those statues to be taken down. CNN reporting on last night's mass shooting in California. The suspect, who police say killed four people, including a nine-year-old boy, at an Orange, California business complex Wednesday, had professional and personal relationships with the victims. Orange Police Lieutenant Jennifer Amott and Police Chief Thomas Casella gave an update today.
The suspect has been identified as 44-year-old Amenadab Gaxiola Gonzalez with a last known address in Fullerton. A photo will be provided at the conclusion of this conference. The preliminary motive is believed to be related to a business and personal relationship which existed between the suspect and all of the victims. It appears all of the adults were connected either by business or a personal relationship, and this was not a random act of violence. The child is believed to be the son of one of the victims who worked at the business. Like I mentioned earlier, as soon as next of kin notifications are made, we are hopeful to be able to release the names of the deceased victims. To reiterate, this appears to be an isolated incident, and we believe everyone knew each other, whether through a business or personal relationship. Investigators will remain on scene throughout the day until the investigation is complete. If anyone has any information about the incident, we would ask them to call the Orange Police Department. I will now turn this over to Orange Police Chief Tom Casella.
Thank you, Lieutenant Amott. Our hearts go out to the victims, their families, our community, and our police department and firefighters. I want to assure everybody that every resource necessary is being committed to this investigation. I want to thank our law enforcement partners, fire department personnel who responded to this horrific event. Finally, I couldn't be more proud of our Orange police officers who responded and engaged the suspect and the detectives who are investigating this crime.
Police Chief Thomas Casella and Lieutenant Jennifer Amott in Orange, California. Amott saying that the business suites where some victims were found belonged to a business identified as Unified Homes, a real estate business specializing in mobile homes. Investigators recovering a semi-automatic handgun and a backpack containing pepper spray, handcuffs, and ammunition. Authorities say they believe they belong to the suspect. Turning to the coronavirus pandemic and vaccinations, from the Associated Press, the company, the center of quality problems that led Johnson & Johnson to discard 15 million doses of its vaccine, has a string of citations from U.S. health officials for quality control problems. Food and Drug Administration repeatedly has cited emergent biosolutions for problems such as poorly trained employees, cracked vials, and problems managing mold and other contamination around one of its facilities. At the White House, a question to the press secretary, Jen Psaki.
And about the Baltimore plant, we understand that there is a contamination of about 15 million doses. When did this happen, and when did the administration find out?
Well, the issue was identified as part of rigorous quality control system checks, and HHS made us aware late last week.
So we understand that this supply is headed to Europe and not for the United States. But how does that really overall sort of change J&J's supply plans? And were they planning to use this plant to deliver the 24 million doses they had planned to deliver by the end of April to the United States?
Well, the issue doesn't impact, one, any of the J&J doses that are available, of course, already on the market. Johnson & Johnson has made clear that they expect to deliver 24 million doses in April and that they expect to meet their commitment of 100 million doses by the end of May. So we are looking forward to that. Obviously, these are doses that the U.S. government has purchased, but we also have plenty of doses from Pfizer and Moderna regardless.
So there is no supply disruption caused by the Baltimore plant for U.S. supply going forward?
For U.S. supply, for the supply that we are anticipating through the course of May, we have been assured that that they expect to meet those deadlines.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. This is Washington Today.
It is only the 1st of April, but already the White House Historical Association releasing today its official 2021 White House ornament. It comes at the same time the association celebrating its 60th birthday. Joining us on the phone is Stuart McLaurin. He is the president of the association. First, happy birthday.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate that.
Let's talk about the ornament. What's the theme? What does it look like?
Well, you know, we've been doing these wonderful ornaments for the past 40 years. Began in 1981 with First Lady Nancy Reagan, and I think it's important to note that they are American-made every year by a veterans-founded small business in Rhode Island. And each one tells the story of a different presidency. Started with George Washington. We are at the Johnson presidency this year, Lyndon B. Johnson. And we've paused 4 or 5 years along the way for example, in 2000 for the 200th anniversary of the White House, we'll pause and commemorate a particular anniversary. But we do otherwise honor, feature each president sequentially, and now we're up to LBJ.
And so the theme this year, what's the ornament look like?
It is really a beautiful ornament. Of course, I would say that. But it is it depicts the 1967 Blue Room Christmas tree from the Johnson presidency. A painting was commissioned by Mrs. Johnson of that tree. And so that's the feature on the front of the ornament. On the reverse, there's quite a powerful and poignant quote by President Johnson that he delivered in a speech responding to the violence in Selma during the civil rights protest. And that quote is very poignant. He said, "Our mission is at once the oldest and most basic of this country, to right wrong, to do justice, to serve man." And then also around that, in a tribute to Mrs. Johnson, there are her favorite Texas blue bonnets that are around that quote on the reverse of the ornament.
And the reaction from the two Johnson daughters?
Well, we actually have had quite a bit of interaction with both Linda and Lucy. They've been involved, of course, with the preparations for this launch. We've done programming with them already, and we'll be doing more throughout this year. And I think they're pleased with it. Each ornament box also includes a booklet that tells the history and the story of that particular presidency. And so Linda and Lucy are featured in a wonderful family photo on the cover of that booklet.
How much planning goes into the White House Christmas ornament, and how far are you looking ahead?
We typically will finalize the design about a year to a year and a half before it goes on sale. It's a collaborative process with our board of directors and my colleagues on the staff and the designer at the manufacturer in Rhode Island. We take input and ideas from family members of former presidents and their presidential libraries. We want to stay away from politics and policy and focus on something special or unique about that particular time in the presidency, and then allow the various conversations and the programming that takes place during the year to unpack more substantive elements in that conversation.
And so based on that, is it safe to assume that already you're talking to the Nixon and the Ford families?
Well, we're giving thought to that. I think it's really important to note that Mrs. Nixon contributed more Americana furnishings and furniture to the White House than any other first lady. We think of Mrs. Kennedy, our founder in 1961, as being so influential with taking the museum, the White House interiors, to a museum standard. But it was actually Mrs. Nixon who made a significant contribution in terms of Americana. Now, that's not saying that's the direction we'll go with the Nixon ornament. But the fun thing about these, Steve, is you don't go with the predictable. You find some story or nuance about a presidency that tells a new story or gets people interested in learning more about that presidency beyond what you know on the surface.
A view of the Blue Room in the White House back in 1967 during the Lyndon Johnson administration. That will be the feature of the 2021 White House Christmas ornament. Stuart McLaurin is joining us on the phone. He is the president of the association. We thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Steve, very much. Always an honor.
You're listening to Washington Today. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says his country's relations with the United States and its allies have hit the bottom, and no date has been set for sending the Russian ambassador back to Washington. Russia recalled its ambassador to the U.S. after President Joe Biden was asked in an interview if he thought that the Russian President Vladimir Putin was a killer, and Biden replied, "I do." At the State Department in Washington, spokesman Ned Price asked to respond.
Foreign Minister Lavrov said U.S.-Russia relations have hit bottom today and said there's no date for their ambassador to come back to Washington. Do you have any response to this?
Well, I think our response would be to point out why the relations are in the state they are. And I think you can look at any number of reasons for that. We have spoken of several of them from this podium in recent weeks, and many of them remain the subject of inquiry, investigation, analysis by the U.S. government, including our intelligence community. We've spoken about Russia's assault on our democracy in 2016 and more recently in 2020. We've spoken of reports of Russian bounties on American soldiers in Afghanistan. We've spoken of Russia's malicious cyber operations, including in the context of SolarWinds. And we've spoken of Russia's imprisonment of Mr. Navalny and the repression and the arbitrary detention of those Russians who peacefully took to the streets to protest Mr. Navalny's arrest, all of which was preceded by Russia's attempt to assassinate Mr. Navalny. So I'm aware of the comments of the Russian foreign minister, but I'm also aware of the backdrop. And that is what is important to us, why we are where we are in terms of the bilateral relationship with Russia. It remains true that we continue to look for a stable and predictable relationship with Russia. Just because we have these profound disagreements, just because the relationship is where it is right now, doesn't mean that there aren't going to be any areas of tactical alignment. And of course, we demonstrated that early on in this administration by renewing the New START agreement for 5 years, precisely because, not because it's in Russia's interest, but because it's in our interest. And so when there are areas for potential cooperation, areas that are in our America's national interest to pursue, we will do that. But that doesn't change the backdrop against which this activity is taking place.
State Department spokesman Ned Price. Russian Foreign Minister Sergey Lavrov also saying in a TV interview about U.S.-Russian relations, there is a hope that they are all grown-up people who realize the risks linked with inciting more tensions. I hope that common sense will prevail, referring to the Americans. Today is Major League Baseball's opening day with some coronavirus precautions in place, touchless ticketing, and limited number of fans allowed in the ballparks, but baseball is back. And the national pastime comes up more often than you might think on C-SPAN. Here's some of the compilation from C-SPAN's video library. See if you can identify all the voices.
Baseball is America. I mean, if you want to be associated with what's truly American, and you're a politician, you better get close to baseball.
You were a captain of the baseball team. And
I was,
did you ever think about being a professional baseball player?
Well, I always was somebody that loved sports, and I always did well at sports. And I loved baseball in particular. I was on the football team, and I was on the wrestling team. Not a great wrestler.
As spring arrives, we'll wait for those final words, play ball. Right?
I consider myself a fan of baseball. I love baseball.
You know, I grew up a baseball fan, and you know, some of my fondest memories are learning how to, you know, switch hit with my father.
We'll celebrate the World Series victory of our beloved Red Sox, and it is going to be an absolute spectacular day in Boston.
Those of you who had to listen to Red Sox fans last year may have gotten a little weary of those of us who have all this pent-up energy when we finally win the championship.
Congratulations especially should go to the Phillies, the Philadelphia Phillies, a fine team, world champions prior to this year, who repeated their championship in the National League and gave the Yankees a very tough time.
From C-SPAN's video library, it was George W. Bush and Donald Trump, both before they were president, Senator Patrick Leahy, Senator Harry Reid, Hillary Clinton, Senator Edward Kennedy, Barack Obama when he was a senator, and Congressman Jose Serrano on this opening day for Major League Baseball. Today is also April Fool's Day, and there were a couple of political-related April Fool's pranks, one from the White House posting a job listing promising to pay more than $100,000 a year to train President Joe Biden's dogs, one of which Major has been in the news for some biting behavior of late. And at the end of the listing in all caps, it says April Fool's. Also, Delaware's Twitter account tweeting, New Jersey and Delaware will be merging to become one state named New Delaware. We're offering New Jersey a fresh start. We'll forget about all that stuff in the past. The capital will be the Delaware Memorial Bridge. Jug handles will be banned, and the full coastline will be the beach. New Jersey's Twitter account responding, delete your account. Well, thanks for joining us today. Download the free C-SPAN Radio app to listen anywhere and get this program as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Hope you have a good evening.